The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Now, I first encountered Abraham Lincoln, like many black people my age, on the walls of just about every black home in Piedmont, West Virginia. When I was growing up, Lincoln's picture was the only white man's picture to hang in black homes other than Jesus himself. Now, I don't know if you all saw, but I was on the Colbert Show last week, and he ended by saying, "So, the director of the Du Bois Institute finally admits that Jesus was a white man." And then he turned up the music and the applause, and I couldn't respond. And what I was going to say is, Stephen, white-ish. But, Jesus, my grandmother was not playing. Jesus had blonde hair and blue eyes, and don't be talking that black stuff about Jesus. Abraham Lincoln was every black person's hero. And he was Booker T. Washington's hero. He was Marian Anderson's hero. And he was Martin Luther King's hero. And even, of course, our man, Barack Obama. But later I learned that Lincoln's attitudes toward race were much more complicated than the simple myth on which we were raised. Now, my engagement with Abraham Lincoln began one rainy Sunday afternoon in my parents' living room when I was 10 years old. And I was bored, and we used to get those Reader's Digest condensed books. Remember those? And I just picked up a volume, and I remember Goodbye, My Lady was in it, and a book by Jim Bishop called The Day Lincoln Was Shot. And that was published in 1955, I later discovered. It was a runaway bestseller. This was 1960. And I sat all day and read that book and cried at the end because it's a sort of hour-by-hour account of the last day of Abraham Lincoln's life. Now, my confusion over Abraham Lincoln began when I was an undergraduate at Yale. And I read an essay it really began my senior year of high school, but I didn't have the scholarly tools to evaluate it, when Ebony Magazine had a cover story called "Was Abe Lincoln a White Supremacist?" written by one of its journalists, a man who I admire very much, a good friend of mine, Lerone Bennett Jr. And as I say in my film, I interview Lerone, and it was on the front page of the New York Times. Every major newspaper in the Western world had this, it was like insulting, a sacred figure for Lerone Bennett to dare ask if Abraham Lincoln was a white supremacist. And Lerone Bennett has now published a 700-page book called Force into Glory, which is really an extension of that essay that was published in Ebony in 1968. But my more sophisticated confusion over Abraham Lincoln began when I was an undergraduate at Yale in my sophomore year, and I read an essay that the great W.E.B. Du Bois published in the magazine that he was editing, of course, the Crisis Magazine. We also know this is the 100th anniversary of the NAACP, and you could give it up for the NAACP. And this essay was published in the May 1922 issue of The Crisis. And Du Bois wrote that, quote, "Lincoln was big enough to be inconsistent." Now listen to these binary oppositions. Du Bois said he was cruel and merciful, peace-loving, a fighter, despising Negroes, and letting them fight and vote, protecting slavery and freeing the slaves. He was a man, Du Bois says, a big, inconsistent, brave man. Now, so many angry letters and letters from hurt people, and particularly African Americans, flooded Du Bois's mailbox that he had to write a second essay defending himself. And this appeared in the September issue of The Crisis Magazine. And this is what Du Bois said in that essay. He said, "I love him not because he was perfect, but because he was not and yet triumphed. The world is full of folk whose taste was educated in the gutter. The world is full of people born hating and despising their fellows. To these I love to say, excuse me, see this man. He was one of you and," sorry, "I've been fighting a cold on the road too much." I like this, like church sisters say, that's right. But I'm going to Napa Valley on Saturday, so that's what I'm talking about. I'm in search of black history in Napa Valley, my love. And if I drink enough wine, I'm sure I'll find it at the bottom of one bottle. Du Bois said, he was one of you, and yet he became Abraham Lincoln. Personally, Du Bois said, I revere him the more because up out of his contradictions and inconsistencies, he fought his way to the pinnacles of the earth, and his fight was within as well as without. I care more for Lincoln's great toe, Du Bois concluded, than the whole body of the perfect George Washington of spotless ancestry who, quote unquote, never told a lie, and Du Bois says, never did anything else interesting. And then to prove his point, Du Bois included this quote, this paragraph from Abraham Lincoln, and it's from a speech he gave at Charleston, Illinois in 1858, and I want to read it to you. I will say, and these are the words of Abraham Lincoln, I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior, and I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. Now, when I read that, I said, say what? We are a long way from the great emancipator. You know, one of my favorite, Carrie Mae Weems is a good friend of mine, and she has this image. Somebody told me about it. I haven't seen it. And it's Lincoln who's disheveled. It looks like he's just waking up from a drunken night. And the caption is, and he looks mystified, and the caption is, I freed the what? Now, when Peter Coonhart, who's my co-executive producer on my PBS series on Lincoln, he's my partner in the Making My African American Life series, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and his family has one of the largest collections of Lincoln memorabilia. When he dragged me in 2 years ago, asking me to co-produce and host a new PBS series on Lincoln, it was a chance for me to ask, will the real Abraham Lincoln please stand up? And looking for Lincoln is an exploration of the many ways in which Americans remake the image of Abraham Lincoln in order to remake ourselves. You see, ladies and gentlemen, every generation since Lincoln's tragic death in 1865 has fashioned an Abraham Lincoln to suit its own needs. As Du Bois pointed out, there are many, many Abraham Lincolns, and among our many Lincolns today are the following. There is Lincoln the Great Emancipator and Lincoln the White Supremacist. There's Lincoln the Tyrant, the War Criminal, Lincoln, the savior of the Union, the redeemer, Lincoln, the warrior, Lincoln, the great peacemaker, Lincoln, the brilliant bureaucrat written about by Doris Kearns Goodwin in her great book, Team of Rivals. There's Lincoln, the conciliator, Lincoln, the politician. There is Lincoln, the gay. There's a book that says that Lincoln is gay. And then there's a book about how he had an affair with Ann Rutledge, and when she died, it broke his heart. He contemplated suicide and then married Mary Todd as a consolation prize. And there's Lincoln the melancholic, deeply melancholic man, but he loved to crack jokes. So there's Lincoln the humorist. Look at this poster on the great atheist, Charles Darwin, and you know today's Darwin's birthday as well. Give it up for Charles Darwin. Oh, there's some creationists in here. Darwin didn't get as many applause, much applause. Look at this poster on atheism. Lincoln the atheist, but Lincoln the American Christ. Remember, Lincoln is assassinated at about 10:20 on Good Friday p.m. He dies 7:22 on Easter Saturday. And by Sunday, Easter Sunday, all throughout pulpits in the North, he's being compared to Christ. So there's Lincoln the American Christ. There's Lincoln the Republican, but there's Lincoln the Communist. Who's Fidel's hero? Not Lenin. It's Abraham Lincoln. There is Lincoln the war criminal in the South, throughout the South, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Lincoln the redeemer with malice toward none. There's Lincoln the writer, and there's Lincoln the orator. And look here, there's Lincoln the opportunist, and Lincoln the pragmatist. There's Lincoln the politician, you know, the manipulative, scrupulous politician. But Lincoln the great statesman, the man above politics. There's Lincoln the leader, and Lincoln the follower, the vacillator. There's the Confederate Lincoln, and there, of course, is the African-American Lincoln. And there's Honest Abe, and then there's Two-Faced Dishonest Abe. And maybe finally, ultimately, there is Lincoln the unknown. And then today, as we celebrate the 200th anniversary of his birth, the Lincoln fable is as vital today as it's ever been. And I filmed for this documentary my friend Malefi Asante. I want to give him a shout out. You are so lucky to have Malefi Asante in your community right there. And, you know, we had a dinner just before, and they wouldn't let me eat, by the way. It was a place that's so cheap. It was terrible. So anybody has a sandwich or something, you can leave it when you give it. No, I can't eat before I talk. But we were able to. Malefi said a nice thing, which is that my series, which aired last night, he said he liked it the best. And I did, too. You know, it was fun. I like my Roots series, and I'm about to do another one. But it was because it was like going back to graduate school for me. You know, I know about African-American culture and history, though I didn't know about Oprah's Roots or Morgan Freeman's Roots, et cetera, et cetera. But this was like going back to graduate school to study Abraham Lincoln. And we filmed all over the country at the most interesting venues, from a Sotheby's auction where I saw an obscure Lincoln letter fetch $3 million, to a convention of Lincoln lookalikes, which you saw. And these guys are so dedicated to living out the values of Abraham Lincoln that they remain in character all year round and go around just reciting the words of Abraham Lincoln. Now, I don't know if they sleep in the top hat, but they wear these uniforms every day. And I went to the annual convention of the Sons of the Confederacy. And I was the first, not the first black journalist, but the first journalist, they told me, ever to film at the Sons of the Confederacy. And I asked the man, what do you think about Abraham Lincoln? He said, he's the biggest war criminal in the history of the United States. And this man was a lawyer in Atlanta, not some redneck on some bicycle, you know? What do you call it? You know, hog, you know, whatever. No, this guy was a subtle man. And he said, Abraham Lincoln is the biggest war criminal in American history, and he should be tried posthumously under the Nuremberg Conventions for war crimes, and his face should be chiseled off Mount Rushmore. I went like, man, I hope the tape on this camera does not break, because nobody is going to believe this. And with Barack Obama's decision to launch his campaign in Springfield, cite Lincoln's oratory over and over again, repeat his train route from here in Philadelphia down to D.C., right before the inauguration, and even use Lincoln's Bible for his swearing-in ceremony, we can see that Lincoln is still very much alive in the American imagination. So in my film, I interviewed Doris Kearns Goodwin and great Tony Kushner, you know, who did Angels in America, who's writing the script for Steven Spielberg's new film on Lincoln. Two presidents, President Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and Lincoln scholars such as David Herbert Donald and Harold Holzer and Drew Faust, president of Harvard, who spent so much time here in Philadelphia. Alan Gelzo is right up at Gettysburg College. David Blight at Yale. Adam Gopnik, the great New Yorker writer. Lerone Bennett, whom I talked to you about. Joshua Schenck, who's written about Lincoln's melancholy. Collector Louise Taper, who owns, you know, every bit of Lincoln memorabilia that's for sale. And a historical interpreter out at Salem, where Lincoln lived, in Illinois. And this woman's in costume for 300 days a year. And I walked in, and as soon as you walk in, they go into their routine, and she's making this pork stew. And I said, how does it feel to devote your life to a man who visited prostitutes, told darky jokes, and used the N-word. And she was so shocked. The camera was rolling. She said, if you say that again, I'll throw your ass right out of here. We cleaned it up for the PBS, though. But the Lincoln we remember today, ladies and gentlemen, is much more a construct of our imaginations, a product of our most wishful thinking and fantasies than a real live human being. Now, take the black community, for example, where he continues to occupy a place of almost holy relevance, our secular saint, our patron saint of race relations, the man who freed the slaves. But it turns out that until very late in his presidency, Lincoln was deeply conflicted about how to liberate the slaves and what to do with them once they had been freed. Whereas abolition was a central aspect of Lincoln's moral compass, racial equality was not. One of the things that I discovered was that there were three strands in Abraham Lincoln's thinking about black people. First, there was slavery, which was an economic institution, which he opposed. Second was racial equality, and Abraham Lincoln had a hard time with the idea of true racial equality to the very end of his life when he began to change. And the third was colonization. And I want to talk briefly about how each one figured into Lincoln's thought. On the one hand, Lincoln despised slavery as an institution that discriminated against white men who couldn't afford the advantage that slaves provided. His father, for example, was a dismal failure economically in Kentucky. And Kentucky was a slave state. And for an average white man to try to compete against white men who had slave labor was a bit like competing with someone on the SATs if they're spotted 400 points out of 800. And so Lincoln hated slavery because the slave society destroyed his father. That's why Lincoln ends up in Indiana and then Illinois, because his father couldn't make it in Kentucky. But on the other hand, he was deeply ambivalent about the status of black people vis-a-vis white people, having fundamental doubts about their innate intelligence and their capacity to fight nobly. Most of us don't realize that even as he was writing the Emancipation Proclamation in the summer of 1862, Abraham Lincoln was working feverishly to ship all the slaves he was about to free out of the United States to Panama. He had earlier embraced ideas, planned to ship them to Liberia first and then to Haiti. On August 14th, 1862, there had been no black men really invited to the White House before, except Paul Cuffey from here in Philadelphia, and who was invited to James Madison's White House in 1812. And Lincoln had one of his minister of colonization call for a rally at the Bethel AME Church in Washington, D.C., and under the guise that Lincoln was going to be there. So the church, as you can imagine, was packed. And his minister said, well, President Lincoln is not here, but he wants you to pick five leaders, and he wants to see them at the White House. And these five men, so they voted, and they picked five men, and these five men went to the White House. Now, this meeting started at 2 o'clock, and they elected five leaders who were then invited to the White House at 4 o'clock to see Abraham Lincoln. And they had no idea why they were invited. And when they walked in, Abraham Lincoln greeted them, and he had a reporter there, which is why we know this story that I'm about to tell you. And he said to them, you all know about the founding fathers, right? George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. He said, you are going to be the founding fathers of a new black nation. I am about to free the slaves. And when I do, we're going to give them money and ship them to Panama, and you are going to run this country. And 1 month and 8 days later, Abraham Lincoln, right after the victory at Antietam, Abraham Lincoln signed the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. None of us knew this. I mean, maybe Lincoln scholars knew this, maybe all of you knew this, but I had no idea. On September 14th, 1862, Lincoln met with anti-slavery ministers from Ohio. And he told them, you know, some people want me to arm black men to fight against the South. But if I do, they're so incompetent that the guns will end up in the hands of the Confederates within a week or 10 days. That was his attitude. It was only the desperate need to defeat the South in the Civil War by using black troops that finally led Lincoln to change his mind. In fact, Charles Sumner, who's like you could think of as the Teddy Kennedy of Massachusetts in the 19th century, Charles Sumner, the great senator from Massachusetts, lobbied Lincoln actively that summer of 1862. And he persuaded him, he and a man named William Casemore, persuaded Lincoln to change his mind by giving him a copy of William C. Nell's book on black patriots in the American Revolution. And we know that black men fought in the American Revolution. My fourth great grandfather's a free Negro named John Redmond, and he fought in the American Revolution. And the founding fathers let blacks fight in the Revolution because they were losing to the British. And guess what? In the summer of 1862, the North was losing to the South. And that is why Abraham Lincoln decided to allow blacks to fight, and he included a provision in the Emancipation Proclamation allowing black men to bear arms, and it's the first time they had done so, really, since the war in 1812 to some extent, but primarily since the American Revolution itself. In his first inaugural address in 1861, referring to what would have been the first 13th Amendment, remember the real 13th Amendment actually abolished the institution of slavery, and it was ratified in December 1865 after Lincoln had been dead, though it was passed under Lincoln's watch. This is what Lincoln said. I understand a proposed amendment to the Constitution has passed Congress to the effect that the federal government shall never interfere with slavery in the slave states. I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. He also vowed that same day to uphold the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which led Frederick Douglass to call him in an editorial in his newspaper an excellent slave hound. In his first annual message to Congress in December 1861, Lincoln requested funds to relocate the slaves who would be freed under the First Confiscation Act and slaves from the border states, and wanted to extend diplomatic recognition to Haiti. Remember, Haiti's independent in 1804, and America won't recognize Haiti because it didn't want to recognize an all-black republic in the New World. He advocated recognizing Haiti and recognizing Liberia, so as Eric Foner puts it, partly to improve prospects of black emigration. August 14th, 1862, just a month before he would sign that preliminary emancipation, as I've told you, he met with those black men to propose colonization, which Frederick Douglass dismissed as a racist, cockamamie idea. In his annual message to Congress, December 1st, 1862, just after announcing that he intended to free the slaves, not in the United States, but in the Confederacy, not freeing the slaves in the border states, he enunciated his full support of their colonization, and this is what I said. Many free Americans of African descent, he says, have made application to him in favor of their emigration. They could go to Liberia or Haiti, with certainty, he says, of being received and adopted as citizens. I regret to say, however, such persons contemplating colonization do not seem so willing to migrate to those countries as to some others, nor so willing as I think their interest demands. I believe, however, he says, opinion among them in this respect is improving, and that ere long there will be an augmented and considerable migration to both these countries from the United States. And then he went on to propose a constitutional amendment that would, I quote, appropriate money and provide otherwise for colonizing free persons of color with their own consent at any place or places without the United States. Then the emancipation, January 1st, 1863, freeing the slaves only in the Confederate States and giving blacks the right to serve as troops. Now, that was the great sea change for Abraham Lincoln. That's what changed Lincoln fundamentally. And this is the Lincoln that you see in the second part of my film and that I discuss in my book, Lincoln on Race and Slavery. Lincoln, who, as you saw, was so dubious about the courage of black men and their intelligence, realized as the tide of the war began to turn that the margin of victory, at least for him, was being provided by those black men. 200,000 black men. Chris Rock's, how many of you saw African American Lives? Two. You saw when Chris Rock cried on camera because I told him that his great-great-grandfather, Julius Caesar Tingman, was a slave until the day Charleston was liberated. The next day, he joins the U.S. Colored Troops and serves nobly for the next year as a member of the U.S. Colored Troop. He had 200,000 fellows, allies, 200,000 black men join the Army and the Navy, the U.S. Colored Troop, served in the military, and they fought nobly. And Lincoln was astonished and fell in love with these guys. He called them his 200,000 black warriors. And often he was getting overtures from the South, peace feelers. And they said, if you only just return those, the slaves, we'll come back in the Union. Just let us have slavery. Because remember in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln advocated gradual emancipation. You know how gradual? 100 years. Now, I was born in 1950. That means I would have been eight. I would have been eight. And Malefi, I'd have been a lousy slave. I'd have flunked slavery. But I'd have been in the big house, I tell you that. Because it was rough out there in the fields, but that's another lecture. Massa hungry, massa hungry. You know, we're raised to think, and I'll be given the high side. I got 5 minutes, so I will talk about the roots in the question session, okay? But I'm almost finished, but I want to wrap this up with Lincoln. We were raised to think that somehow Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation in Washington, and all our ancestors said, that's it, massa. See you later. I'm walking off the plantation. That was not happening, you know? As far as the South was concerned, it was another country. It's like England or France. They didn't care what Abraham Lincoln said. But if a slave could get behind Union lines, then legally he or she was free if they could get back to the North. There were 3.9 million of our ancestors who were slaves in 1860, and only, or as many as, depending on your point of view, 500,000 were able to become free through the Emancipation Proclamation. All the rest remained slaves and became free in various ways. What really dismantled the institution of slavery, and Lincoln knew this, was the 13th Amendment, which Lincoln rammed through the Congress and then insisted on signing. Usually presidents don't sign an amendment to the Constitution. But in February, when it was passed, he insisted on signing it, and he said he would be remembered for that more than anything else. And it was then it went out to the states, and it was ratified in December. Why did Lincoln die? This is a story most of us don't know. The South capitulates. You know, there's Appomattox, April 11th. All these people go to the White House. They've been there the night before. Lincoln hated making spontaneous, extemporaneous speeches. A carefully crafted writer. And they were chanting, Lincoln, Lincoln. Finally, at night, Lincoln comes out, second floor of the White House. He flings open the windows and he gives a speech. And he says, among other things, that for the first time in his life, for the first time in the history of the presidency, he believes that some black men should be given the right to vote. His 200,000 black warriors. Now, remember, all white men had the right to vote, no white women. But he wanted some black men to have the right to vote. His 200,000 black warriors, he said, and the quote-unquote very intelligent Negroes. Who's he referring to? He's referring to the man who is responsible for the second reason that Abraham Lincoln began the change. And that, of course, was Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, as you heard me quote, was an ardent and passionate critic of Abraham Lincoln, because Lincoln was doing everything to get the South back, everything to appease the South in the early years of his presidency. And when he was elected, he had all kind of overtures to them. We won't touch slavery, et cetera, et cetera. But finally they met, and indeed they met three times before Lincoln's tragic death. And Frederick Douglass said his first time a white man treated him fully as an equal. And ladies and gentlemen, it was the first time that Abraham Lincoln met a black man who was his intellectual equal. You know, there's a cult of Lincoln in the historical profession. So they say, oh, Lincoln knew lots of black people. And you say, who? They say, Billy the Barber. You know, you know, offense to Billy the Barber, but he wasn't exactly Frederick Douglass. You know what I mean? it was the first time. And Lincoln says Douglass was one of the most meritorious men in the whole United States. And once he even sent a telegram to Rochester and asked Lincoln to come so he could seek his counsel on a matter of state. And Douglass had great respect for Abraham Lincoln. So it was the 200,000 black troops and this most intelligent Negro, Frederick Douglass, that made Abraham Lincoln start to sneak up on the idea of racial equality, which he announces to everyone's astonishment in the last speech that he gave in his life. Guess who's in the audience? Guess who's on the grounds of the White House that night? John Wilkes Booth. John Wilkes Booth hears him embrace limited suffrage for black men, turns to a white man who gave his testimony later, who's standing next to him, and says, "That's it. That means nigger citizenship, and I'm going to run him through." And 3 days later, John Wilkes Booth creeps into the presidential booth at the Ford Theater. They're watching Our American Cousin, and he shoots him. So Lincoln literally gave his life, literally, for the right, so that some black men could have the right to vote. How ironic. What an arc of progress from that speech with which I started my speech this evening. Frederick Douglass immediately eulogized Lincoln as the black man's president. But then, at the dedication of the Freedom, what's called the Freedom, the Lincoln Memorial Monument, which is the Freedom's Monument in Lincoln Park, which you saw with the tall Lincoln and the crouching slave, Douglass, never before had a white, powerful group of people been assembled to hear a black person speak. President Ulysses S. Grant was there. The vice president was there. The entire Supreme Court, all the cabinet, all of the Senate, and all of the House. And this monument was funded entirely by the donations of former slaves. And it's the first American monument to Abraham Lincoln, the Freedmen's Memorial Monument. And give it up for the slaves. But to their shock, what Douglass said was, "We at best are Abraham Lincoln's stepchildren. You are his children." Abraham Lincoln was, first and last, Douglass says, the white man's president. What he did in the interest of white people first and black people secondarily. And no one could believe that Douglass would say this at this sacred moment. And Douglass even included that speech as an appendix to both editions of his autobiography, one published in 1891 and one published in 1892. And ironically, he said in the same speech, if Abraham Lincoln is memorialized, he said, this will be the last, and there it is right there, this will be the last monument that black people ever create to Abraham Lincoln. He said, if Abraham Lincoln's remembered, it will be through monuments created by white people. But what happened? You know, the person who single-handedly changed that was Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. Washington, at what the great black historian Rayford Logan called the nadir of the low point of African-American history, which is the decade of the 1890s and the early teens, when Plessy v. Ferguson is announced by the Supreme Court in 1896 and Jim Crow segregation becomes legal, Booker T. Washington realized that he needed a powerful symbol to beat up on these fellow white Americans. And so he resurrected Abraham Lincoln as his hero, and he published a series of lithographs called the Onward Series, with Abraham Lincoln in one oval over his left shoulder, Frederick Douglass in the other oval. Douglass dies in 1895, and Booker T. Washington, like their son, in the middle. And Lincoln was the great emancipator. Representation of Lincoln, of course, is reinforced with Marian Anderson singing in 1939 at the Lincoln Memorial when the Daughters of the American Revolution, boy, that's a Freudian slip, the Daughters of the American Revolution wouldn't allow her to sing at Constitution Hall. And then, of course, it was solidified forever in granite when Martin Luther King gave the greatest speech of the 20th century, right, virtually in the shadow of Lincoln's monument, and most recently Barack Hussein Obama, who has thoroughly wrapped himself in the mantle of Abraham Lincoln. I guess that how I feel in the end, I feel that Lincoln was a recovering racist. I think that he was wrestling with his demons. I think he was the greatest American president. And I think that these words of W.E.B. Du Bois sum it up best. The scars and foibles and contradictions of the great do not diminish, but enhance the worth and meaning of their upward struggle. It was the bloody sweat that proved the human Christ divine. It was his true history and antecedents that proved Abraham Lincoln a prince of men. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Malefi. Thank you. Now, we have microphones floating around. I know you want to ask me about how to do your DNA. So you can ask me about Abraham Lincoln. You can ask me about DNA. I have two books that just happened to have come out at the same time. And one of them consists of the 19 chapters. There have been 19 people that I've put in my African American Lives series. And I just got the funding for a new series. But for the new series, I'm going to do two Jewish Americans, two Arab Americans, two Latino Americans. Eva Longoria just agreed to be in it. Now, you know I'm going to be hard to talk to, Malefi, when I interview Eva Longoria. Two Asian Americans, two West Indian Americans. So that should be pretty exciting, too. It's going to be called The Faces of America. But the book that I just published, I've edited a book of everything Lincoln said about race and slavery, including the darkie jokes that he told. Every time he used the word nigger, which he did use before he became president, we have one documented case of him using it in 1862 after he became president. And I have a long critical essay analyzing these three strands in his thought. That's one book. But the other book consists of 19 chapters, a chapter each on the family tree of Oprah Winfrey, Maya Angelou, all the people who've been in my series, an analysis of their DNA and what their DNA says about their African origins or their European origin. You know, if we did the DNA of all the black men in this room, and a lot of black men in this room, 25% of you, your Y DNA is what makes a man a man. 25% of you will trace your Y DNA to Europe, not to Africa at all, and that's because, in most cases, overwhelmingly because of the slave trade, because of the victimization of black women by white men in the slave trade. But I say that victimization, and I would say that's overwhelmingly, that would accurately describe overwhelmingly the power relationship. But as you saw in African American Lives too, Morgan Freeman's grandfather was the overseer on a plantation. And he impregnated, his name is Alfred Carr, and the slave's name was Seeley. And then 1865, she's liberated by the end of the Civil War. 1870, they're living in the same household. And I was able to show Morgan Freeman. I knew that he had been looking for their gravestone. They'd never been able to find it. And our researchers found it. And they were buried next to each other. And they had several children together and lived illegally after that. So, you know, these issues are very, very complicated. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the sexual exploitation of anyone. I'm just saying that, were they in love or not? You know, who knows? But they ended up living their life together and are buried next to each other. But the point is, we are a mixed people. We are, when you do, I have never tested anybody who was pure. I tested Chris Rock on a Thursday. I revealed the results. And, you know, Chris is so crazy. And I said, you're 90% white, European, and 81% African. And he said, whew, at least I'm not as black as Don Cheadle. You know, he's so cool. So, the following Sunday, I'm in Toronto, where Don Cheadle is making that movie that just came out about, you know, he appears to be, a terrorist. And I said, before I reveal the DNA results, I just want you to know what Chris Rock said. He said, at least I'm not as black as Don Cheadle. He said, well, tell Chris Rock and kiss my black ass. You know? Don Cheadle was 20% European and 80%. T.D. Jakes, You know, if you think about the phenotypes, the colors, the hair textures of my guests, I picked people I liked. I picked some people who were my friends, like Dr. Ben Carson, who was my classmate at Yale. I've known him since 69. Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery, of course, at Johns Hopkins, the first surgeon successfully to separate Siamese twins and joined at the head. I wanted to disappoint. I didn't want all black athletes and entertainers. You know, I wanted a black astronaut like Mae Jemison. But I wanted dark-complected black people, medium-complected black people, light-complected black people. And that's what I got. And that way we got such a rich panoply of colors and hair textures and family stories from the black community. And everywhere I go, people stop me. I mean, just regular black people. You know, the people who take your bag at the airport, or the people who shine your shoes, or, you know, just regular people. And they say, you know, you did good job on that DNA thing, you know, or that family tree thing. And I said, thank you. And I think that what I've learned, and this is what I write about in the book, an excerpt was in the New Yorker in December. It was really about my family, which is not in the book, but will be part of another book. Is that, you know, we all think of black history as the big Negroes, as we used to put it. You know, no one could say you'd never heard of Frederick Douglass. Everybody's heard of Frederick Douglass. And Sojourner Truth and Phyllis Wheatley and Harriet Tubman and Mary McLeod Bethune. But historians, if you look at their footnotes, generalize from a very tiny sample often of what black people did. You all have stories on your family tree that Malefi Asante, I do not know about, that we cannot draw upon in the literature, that we cannot use to generalize. We cannot use as evidence to generalize from, like Julius Caesar Tingman, who didn't exist till we found him for Chris Rock. Like all the people in the family trees of the stories that I told in both African American Lives. We can revolutionize our understanding of African American history if you all just go home and do your family trees. That's serious. That is really serious. And you know what I'm trying to do? I have a group of scholars working now with me at the Du Bois Institute when we're trying to revolutionize the way we teach science and history to inner city black kids. You know, when we were growing up in the 1950s, the blackest thing you could be was a lawyer and doctor. And now people want to be, you know, a hip-hop star. Nothing wrong with that, except I hate hip-hop, but other than that, no, I'm just joking. See, I'm old school. I have XM radio, and I just have Soul Street soldered on there. I don't want anybody to touch it. I want to rock with the Supremes and get down with James Brown, and I don't want to hear about no hip-hop. That's my music. But the real reason is, has nothing to do with music. It's got to do with Sylvia Brooks' basement, where we had parties, you know. And so it has certain associations for me. But our people have lost their way. Too large a segment of our people have lost the passion for learning that's a fundamental part of the African-American tradition. So I think, Malefi, that we go in there and we say, all right, this is science class, and we're going to teach you about the double helix and Watson and Crick, the structure of DNA. If you and I walked in there, people would say, get out of town. What's that got to do with being black? Or what's that got to do with anything? But if we go in there with a Q-tip and say, you're going to scrape your cheek, everybody in this class, and we're going to send it away to this lab, and 6 weeks later, we're going to tell you what tribe or ethnic group your family came from in Africa. And while we wait for the results, we're going to teach you about DNA and this man named Watson and Crick and the double helix and how that works. And then in history class, we're going to have them do their family tree. The first week, we're going to have electronic family trees. First week, them. The second week, their parents. Where they were born, when they were born. The third week, their grandparents. They're going to interview everybody alive in their household older than they are in the next generation. Even if, you know, everybody makes up stories. You know, we didn't have family trees, so we made up the family tree. But you've got to collect the family trees. Then we're going to look for the evidence. You know, the censuses are all online back up to 1930 because privacy rules, it's only up to 1930. When they get back to somebody born as early as 1930, we're then going to take them online to use the census. Take them to Ancestry.com and search for records. Then we're going to take them all the way back to 1870. Everybody in here could get to 1870. 1870 is when all of our ancestors first had legal names. The slaves could call themselves George Washington Madison Jones, but the law called you black 23-year-old male. You had no name. That was before the law because we were property. Insofar as a dog or a chicken or a cow can have a name, we could have a name. except for tax lists, but I'll get to that in a minute. So we can get everybody black, unless you're extraordinarily unlucky, back to 1870. Then what we do, like in the case of Oprah Winfrey, we found her great-grandfather's name was Constantine Winfrey. We could go back to 1870. There he is in the census. He's living next door to a white man named Absalom Winfrey. He's 33 years old. So we go and look at the slave schedule, which is the white census, or the census of free people in 1860, and it had a separate slave schedule for white men or women who owned slaves. So you look, if Constantine Winfrey's 33 in 1870, if Absalom Winfrey owns a black man who's 23 in 1860, that's our man. Right there sitting pretty. 23-year-old black male. They're living next to each other. And Constantine takes the man's name as soon as he's free and has a legal name. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And here's a hero. We talk about heroes like Frederick Douglass or Booker T. Washington. Constantine Winfrey, in 1876, walks up to this white man named John Watson, who had 80 acres of beautiful prime land with a little creek going through it, gently rolling hills. And he says to him, you can imagine, 1876, that's the year Reconstruction ends. In Mississippi, probably had to call him boss. He said, boss, you know, you got 80 acres of fine land, and I know you could use some cotton, because, you know, cotton's a valuable commodity. So he's going to give him eight bales of clean or lint cotton, which weigh 1,200 pounds. Now, you know how light a cotton ball is. So he had to pick it on his own time and clean it. And he said, if I do that in 2 years, you'll give me that 80 acres of land. And that white man who fought for the Confederacy entered into an agreement. And it was, if you read the contract, it was cold, man. It said, if you 1 ounce less than 8 bales of cotton weigh, I get all the cotton and I keep the land. Well, John Watson dies while Constantine's busy picking all that cotton. And his widow, we know that Constantine picked the cotton because I hand Oprah on camera a copy of the deed signing over that 80 acres of land from the widow of John Watson and signed by his son to Constantine Winfrey. Now, and then a year later, that's 1881, 1882, Constantine pays $250 cash for the adjacent 250 acres. You want to know why Oprah Winfrey's Oprah Winfrey? Because of that brother. That's true. And all of you are in this room because somebody on your family tree did something like that and got you in here. That is the truth, no matter how small it might seem. And you can spend your time exploring it. What is your favorite subject? Your favorite subject is yourself. Is yourself. And we need to tell our stories. So what I've learned by doing African American history is that restoring black history starts in the home. Black history starts at home. It starts in the living room or the kitchen or the parlor. It starts with us verifying the stories that we've been telling ourselves, doing our family trees, and then when the paper trail runs out, doing your DNA and finding out, doing roots for the 21st century, roots in a test tube, finding out where in Africa you come from or where in Europe. You know, as I said, we are a mixed... we are mixed people, though we all believe. How many of you have Native American ancestry? Black people. None of y'all got Native American ancestry. All black people think, they all say, this is funny, we almost call this episode High Cheekbones and Straight Black Hair. My grandmama, my great-grandma, high cheekbones and straight hair down to her behind. Everybody says that, right? Only 5% of the African American people have any Native American ancestry, but 100% think you do. I'm sure all y'all do. I'm sure all y'all, because people come up to me at the book signing. People say, "Dr. Gates, that's what you said about the mother Negroes. I know that's true, but not me, because I got a picture of my grandmother, right?" Don Cheadle. Remember what I had to tell Don Cheadle? Don Cheadle's family was owned by the Chickasaw. They were marched in the Trail of Tears. You all know about the Trail of Tears? Trail of Tears was about cotton. It was about cotton. The Indians were sitting on the richest soil in the world for growing cotton. The five civilized tribes, you know why they were called the five civilized tribes? Because they owned black slaves. The Creek, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Cherokee, and the Seminole all were huge slave owners. And when they were kicked out, 1830, the Indian Removal Act, and they kicked each tribe out through a trail of tears, and they end up in what was called Indian Territory, which is now the state of Oklahoma. And they took their slaves with them. And the Chickasaw were rough. Chickasaw governor in 1885 issued a statement that said, I don't see why we have to free our slaves just because the Confederacy wimped out to the north. I mean, that is cold, man. You know, all these fantasies about the slaves running away and smoking the peace pipe with the Seminoles whooping on the white man. It didn't happen, man. It was not like that. It might have happened in 1% of the cases, but it didn't happen like that. The Chickasaw kept their slaves stateless from 1865 to 1898 when the Dawes Commission, appointed by the federal government, went to Oklahoma and said, you have got to make these ex-slaves citizens. And the Native Americans did not want to do it. And they said, we will not let you in the Union as a state. Oklahoma becomes a state in 1907 until you give the former slaves citizenship status. And Don Cheadle's family is one of those families. And guess what? When the federal government forced the Native Americans to give the blacks, former slaves, citizenship status, it also forced them to give them 40 acres of land. So the people who truly got the 40 acres were all of the black people who were able to survive till the end of the century with the Native Americans. And when we did Don Cheadle, so I said, well, here's somebody who's going to have a lot of Native American ancestry. Don Cheadle has zero Native American ancestry. Only Mae Jemison, the astronaut, Oprah, and Chris Tucker had a significant amount of Native American ancestry. So only 5%, but many, many more African Americans have a significant amount of European ancestry. And what we would take, the cheekbones hair story, is really, in far more cases than not, a result of black-white admixture than of Native American and African American ancestry. And if you think about it, if you know anything about American history, the average slave didn't even see a Native American. The reason that Chris Tucker and Oprah have Native American ancestry is that we could trace their ancestors coming down from the Upper South to Mississippi, Alabama, at the same time Native Americans are there before they're being forcibly removed on the Trail of Tears. You have to sleep with somebody, you have to be able to see them. And most, you know, in 1860, there were 60 Native Americans, 60, or no, 80, I'm sorry. In 1860, there were 80 Native Americans in the state of South Carolina, and there were 388,000 black slaves. Now, unless those 80 Native Americans doing a lot of sleeping around, you know, like, it wasn't going to happen. So what I want to do is introduce this curriculum and revolutionize the way we teach science and the way we teach history to inner-city kids so that using these techniques, we can take our people not back to the future, but black to the future. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, fire away. Ask some questions. Ask me a question. Malefi Asante. Dr. Asante.
That's right. Thank you very much, Skip. I really enjoyed the presentation. It was,
thank you, buddy.
Extraordinary. Question about Barack Obama's fascination with Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Could you give us any insight into why you think that President Obama has this intense identification with Lincoln?
Yeah, thank you, Malefi. I've been thinking about that a lot, as everyone has, because I wrote an essay. It was in the New York Times on Martin Luther King Day. I wrote it with John Stauffer, my colleague at Harvard. Everyone is asking, you know, why Barack and Lincoln, but no one was asking what would Lincoln think of Obama. And the short answer is Lincoln would be shocked. I mean, if we brought Lincoln back from the dead, he'd have a heart attack and die all over again to find out. I mean, he was sneaking up on racial equality. He could not imagine a black man being in the White House. And the curious thing is, okay, after we revived him, he would say, he's mixed. Yeah, we'd say, he'd say, well, like Douglas. He'd look at him and say, well, he's tall like Douglas. And he's a great orator like Frederick Douglass. And a great writer. We tell him, you know, like Frederick Douglass, he became a great a national figure at the age of 40, before the age of 45. So superficially, he would think he was like Frederick Douglass. But when he got to know him, he would realize he was very little like Frederick Douglass. Barack Obama is no radical. Douglass is in the Cornell West is in the Frederick Douglass tradition, the prophetic tradition, you know, speaking truth to power. Barack is a centrist. The most radical thing about Barack, and I say this as a person who's a centrist myself, the most radical thing about Barack is that he's black. And he somehow beat the system and fooled all these white people into voting for him. Which is amazing. I mean, I supported Barack Obama, don't get me wrong. But I didn't believe he could beat Hillary. I told him to his face, I didn't believe he could beat Hillary, and I didn't believe that white people were going to vote for him to be president of the United States. I told him I was just joking when I saw him. I was with you all the time, bro. But he and Lincoln were both improvisatory pragmatists and genius at it. Barack can see around corners, man, and he can adapt. You know, he's got the swivels, and so could Lincoln. And Lincoln would realize that that Barack Obama is more like anybody who sat in that Oval Office since he did. They are fundamentally alike. That's the first reason. That I think that when Barack looks in the mirror, he sees Abraham Lincoln looking back at him. The second thing is Barack Obama is enormously ambitious. And so if you're going to model yourself after somebody, why not model yourself after the greatest president in the history of the United States? And Barack wants to be remembered as the greatest president in the history of the United States. So he's picked Lincoln. But I think the third reason is more curious and far more speculative. And I think that it is reflected in Booker T. Washington's similar fascination with Abraham Lincoln. You know, neither knew their father. Booker T. Washington never knew who his father was, except he was thought to be a white man. Barack knew who his father was, but never knew his father. You know, read his autobiography, Dreams of My Father. And he's a substitute father figure for Barack Obama in a curious way. And as I said, that's much more speculative, but I believe that it's true. I mean, every president has been fascinated with Abraham Lincoln since 1865, but nobody has been as fascinated with Abraham Lincoln as Barack Obama. I mean, quoting his oratory, as I said in the first half of my talk, retracing the route using the Bible. I mean, good Lord. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he has a top hat and a beard at night. You know, I don't know what he does. But I think all of us, you know, now that it's Lincoln's birthday, I hope Barack puts Lincoln back in the, you know, on the mall for a while and we get on with the business. I want my 401k to go back up, you know. And if that'll help the brother do that, then Abraham Lincoln all the way. Give me a hand. Yes, and over there.
History. Your research reveals much about black history since slavery. I have a site at www.beforebc.de looking at black history before Christ, before Columbus, before slavery. Uh-huh. And if you'd be so kind, I'd like to give you this booklet after the talk is over. And if you'd be so kind as to take a look at it, and if you thought it merited your support,
I'd be glad to look at it.
Thank you very much, brother.
If you'd be able to, yes? After you buy my book, I'll be glad to look at your book.
I will buy your book. And please be so kind as to write a letter of endorsement if you think it merits it. Thank you very much, brother.
You know what? Even if you don't buy the book, brother, I'll be glad to look at it. I'm not a scholar of, ancient African history. I'm an amateur. I'm fascinated, with it as many of us are. But I'm very interested in this field. The identity of the Egyptians is something we all have deep concerns about, and ancient African history. So, you know, I'm very interested in your work. How about a woman? Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I read the book, The Real Eve, and it's a book by an author who talks about tracing the history of multiple cultures through DNA.
What's it called?
The Real Eve.
The Real Eve. Oh, I haven't read it.
Yes. And he actually describes, like, multiple cultures through their DNA. And he describes how they left Africa and went everywhere in the whole world.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
Right.
The problem is he didn't describe what happened to the DNA and how the Africans had populated Africa. Do you know of any book that I can find?
Oh, sure.
That kind of goes over what happened to the Africans, like maybe it was like, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago.
50,000 years ago. What happened was they became white people. I mean, it's true. I mean, they mutated out over a long period of time. But we all started. Now, geneticists will argue about whether it was southern Africa. That's a new theory. But most of us agree or believe that it was in Ethiopia. And that's where our mitochondrial Eve came from. So if you go to the Genographic Project and pay $99, they'll send you a map. The human community starts in Ethiopia. And either it goes toward Australia through India or it goes north through Europe that way. But we're all Africans. The only question is how recently we're Africans. But I would recommend the work of Spencer Wells. Spencer Wells, he's got two books. He runs the Genome Project. He's a Harvard PhD. He's a very distinguished guy. He makes documentaries, too. And it's very easy to understand, very simple, very solid, and very reliable. And if anybody wants to know about where to get your DNA tested, African Ancestry is run by my friend Rick Kittles, who I've featured in my series. I started a company called AfricanDNA.com. We're cheaper than Rick's. I didn't say that, really. But there are a lot of good places out there, and you should do it. I think that you want me to finish? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to sign books, so you can ask me questions in line. Thank you for welcoming me back to Philadelphia. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. That was great.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.